It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Language. From expressing love to describing grief, we often rely on words to express how we feel. But there are times when words fail us. Why is that? Well, that's one of the big questions asked by the book Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Do you remember a moment in your life where words just couldn't convey how you felt? Do you find power in silence, or does too much of it scare you? Do you have difficulty speaking up or discussing certain aspects of your life? Are you trying to overcome that? If so, what helps you to find your voice? Has shame or trauma ever held you back from talking about something, even with a loved one? And is talking always the answer? Are there just some things better left unsaid? Share your stories. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Harriet Shawcross is a filmmaker and journalist, and her new book is Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Harriet, welcome to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book comes from a very personal place for you. You spent a year without speaking unless you really had to. Was this book an effort, in a way, to make sense out of your own experiences?
Yeah, I think it was. Like that year, I was about kind of 12, 13, so kind of just growing up, and it was a really formative time for me. I was at a kind of very big, academic, prestigious school, and just for whatever reason, when I kind of went through the school gates, would just find that that I had nothing to say. Like, the way I talk about it in the book is that I stopped communicating in the ways that make us human. So if someone said, you know, what do you think about this, I'd have an answer for them. But in terms of actually just, you know, making conversation with people, kind of chatting, telling jokes, all that kind of stuff, I wasn't able to do it. And it kind of stayed with me for a long time. Like, I was able to talk normally, as you say, after about a year of this. But that kind of survival mechanism of slightly retreating from the world, of just kind of fading into the background a bit, was something that definitely stayed with me right into adulthood. And you're right, I think the process of writing the book was partly exploring that and kind of saying, you know, what's that about? Why have I hung on to this? And is that a useful way to be living? And also, why are there things that we're not able to talk about? Why did I kind of go back to that method of surviving by not saying anything?
So what were the causes? What prompted this year of relative silence?
So for me, it was quite straightforward in a way. I went to this, it was a boarding school. I don't know kind of how common that is in the US, but it was kind of prestigious UK boarding school. And I was told by this very kind of stern housemistress when I arrived that I was a day girl and I was one of only three in a year of 100 people. And I was told by this housemistress, you know, it would be really good if you didn't mention the fact that you were going to be going home in the evenings, and don't talk about home life because it might upset all the other girls who were stuck at school. And I kind of really took this to heart and was like, right, okay, I won't. So there was this kind of instruction from school not to talk about anything that was going on beyond school. And then my father lost his job. He was made redundant. And I think for my family particularly, it was felt to be a very, very shameful thing. And again, the instruction from my mother was, don't tell people what's happening here. Don't tell people what's happened with Dad and that he's not working. So I had kind of on both sides people saying, don't talk about what is happening for you. And I think as a kind of 12-year-old, I wasn't able to navigate my way through that. And so I did just withdraw, particularly at school, and just found that I wasn't really able to talk to anyone about what was actually happening for me.
And how did you manage to emerge from that?
Well, it was kind of a gradual process, but the kind of event that kind of triggered coming out the other side was I took part in this big poetry reading event, and I'm very good at reading poetry. It's a bit of a useless skill. I guess everyone's got one. That's mine. And it felt like if I was able to just stand up in front of, it was in front of, you know, the whole school, so several hundred people, if I was just able to stand up in front of them and say some words, even if they were someone else's words, then that would somehow, I don't know, in my mind, I kind of felt like that would be enough to kind of start normal conversations again, and at least show everyone that I had a voice and I had something to say. So that kind of public poetry reading event was the start of being able to start to build relationships with people and have a more kind of normal understanding of language and of conversation. But I think in a way it wasn't so much that I wanted to talk again, it was that I wanted everything that comes with talking, like, you know, friends, just kind of human connection, that very basic thing. So mm-hmm. I think it was also just that desire to kind of connect with people again.
Harriet Shawcross is the author of Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. What's the difference between not wanting to speak and not being able to speak? Because you explore both of those things in your book.
Yeah, interesting. So when I first started looking into this period of my life when I didn't talk, I thought one of the things that might have happened to me is that I might have had this condition called selective mutism, which is quite common. It's about 1 in 150 kids that will get it. And it's where you find yourself completely unable to talk in certain situations. Most commonly that's at school. So you get to school and are not talking in the classroom, but you might be talking totally normally at home. And that in that case, in the past, a lot of people thought that kids with this disorder just didn't want to talk, that they were just being difficult, or they were being stubborn, or they were shy. And now I think the understanding is that actually what's happening is something quite similar to having like a phobia of speaking in certain situations. And when you talk to these kids or to adults that have come out the other side of this, they'll say very much that, of course, you know, there were things I wanted to say, you know, desperately, but just did not feel able to do that. And I think that is really corrosive and has a huge effect on who you are as a person. If you're just not able to say what you need to say and to be heard, whereas obviously not wanting to say something, I mean, you have control of that, right? So you're deciding not to do that. And I think that's a very different thing.
Do we as a society have a sort of an aversion to silence the way nature has an aversion to vacuums?
Interesting. Maybe. I mean, it can feel that way. Like, I think especially with the way things are at the moment with kind of, you know, social media and the pressure to kind of reply to emails all the time as soon as you get them, and that there always has to be, and, you know, the 24-hour news cycle, the feeling that, you know, there's always got to be words to be filling the void and describe what's happening. So maybe we do have a slight aversion to silence. And I mean, in the book, I went and intentionally spent quite a lot of time with people that have spent a lot of time in silence, looking at what that does to them and to their lives. And I guess asking whether, you know, silence is something that we could probably all do with a little bit more of in our lives.
Well, there's an old proverb about silence being golden, and my father used to quote it to me, because apparently I was talking when I was born and I never shut up, which can be the opposite problem.
I mean, that can be the opposite problem.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit. It's a real thing.
What, talking too much?
Yeah, people that just don't, you know, they feel compelled to speak all the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I was going to say, I was aware saying that we probably all need more silence in our lives, a bit of a crazy thing to be saying, you know, on talk radio. But anyway, people that talk too much, I guess what's interesting in the book, I also look at like the Samaritans, which is a kind of helpline in the UK for people that might be experiencing kind of suicidal or despairing feelings. Mm-hmm. And part of the big challenge for them is like training people to actually listen, to not just always be like diving in with the next comment, with the next thing that you want to say.
Listening to like, actually listen, you know, instead of listening to respond. We need to take a break. We'll continue our conversation with Harriet Shawcross, filmmaker and journalist, about her new book, Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Join us with your question or comment about silence or not being able to speak. 800-642-1234 or tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Harriet Shawcross is a filmmaker and journalist. Her new book is Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say, and we're talking about those times and situations when language fails us, when we cannot or will not speak. Listeners, do you remember a moment in your life where words just could not convey how you felt? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. Do you find power in silence? Do you appreciate it, or does too much of it make you uneasy? Do you have difficulty speaking up or discussing certain aspects of your life? Maybe shame or trauma has held you back from talking about something, even with a loved one. And is talking always the answer? Are there just some things better left unsaid? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Harriet, you mentioned a little bit ago that you found yourself turning to poetry at various points in your life. And I think we can all relate to this. We've all got a favorite poem or a passage from some writing or maybe a paragraph that we turn to for comfort or inspiration. Why is it, do you think, that we often rely on the words of others?
Well, I think it depends. So when I was talking to speech therapists who've been working with kids particularly who struggle to speak, whether that's through selective mutism or some form of anxiety, they kind of explained to me that there's a hierarchy of language. So the most difficult thing to do is kind of what we're doing now. So kind of spontaneous conversation where you don't know what the next person's going to say, you don't know what they're going to think of you, they might tell you that you've done it wrong, you might have to repeat yourself. That, for someone who struggles to speak, is the worst possible thing. And the easiest thing, in a way, is reading someone else's words, because you're not going to get it wrong. You're not going to have to repeat yourself. So I guess on that extreme level, where there's kind of a lot of anxiety involved, that can be why using someone else's words can feel safer. I think for me, certainly, that's probably partly why doing that poetry reading was a way to kind of prove, like, I do have a voice and I can do this. But you know, I was just very anxious, and it was, in a way, using someone else's words instead of mine was a lot easier for me. You know, and I guess we've all come across times when, you know, poets and writers can say things perhaps better than we can ourselves. And that, I guess, is always, you know, reassuring and nice to turn to that as well.
There's one poet in particular that you found yourself drawn to, George Aupin. When you were revisiting his poems in advance of your wedding, you noticed something in his work, or maybe you noticed something that wasn't in his work. What was it that drew you to him, and what was it you found?
Yeah, so again, I don't know how much your listeners will know about George Aupin. He's not well known in the UK at all, but he's this, you know, amazing poet who writes these they're quite sparse poems. When you look at the poem on the page, there's kind of not a lot there. And when I was looking for a poem for my wedding, I found this poem called The Hills, which I just felt completely expressed how I was feeling in terms of the love for the other person, your kind of, you know, hopes for the future. And then once I started doing more reading about him. And what's interesting about George Aupin is that he had this period in his life from the 30s to the 60s where he didn't publish any poetry. But more than that, there is this kind of huge silence in his life. So he's someone that wrote, you know, from the 60s onwards, you know, these huge letters every day, you know, a real kind of living correspondence. He was always writing poetry, always saving drafts of poems. And these, you know, these drafts would be saved alongside kind of shopping lists and letters and this huge catalogue of work. But for this 30 years in the middle of his life, there's nothing. He didn't write poems. He didn't save poems, didn't save letters. There's this kind of hole in the archive. And I found that really interesting of kind of why would this poet who in the 30s was hailed as being this, you know, bright new voice by Ezra Pound and had published this collection of poetry that was really highly praised. Why would someone in that position suddenly just stop for 30 years? Like, what was it that stopped him from being able to express anything? And then at the end of his life, from the 60s onwards, he spends a lot of time going over that kind of silent period, kind of reworking it through his poetry and figuring out, you know, what had happened. So I found the way that he looks at silence really interesting and what it was that kind of stopped him from writing for that period of time.
What eventually broke his silence?
It's kind of a long story. So, it was a dream, basically. He has a really interesting, this is the other frustrating thing about him. He has this amazing life, but there's this whole chunk in the middle that isn't really documented or not documented by him. So he kind of stopped writing during the Great Depression, and then following that went and fought during the Second World War, came back, and because he'd been a member of the Communist Party, he fell under the suspicion of Senator McCarthy, and so he left with his wife and young daughter and went into exile in Mexico and lived there for about 10 years. And then eventually they got passports and were able to go back to the States. So in a, on a physical sense, that's what started him writing again, was coming out of exile, moving back to the West Coast of America, settling down and kind of, in a way, processing everything that had happened. But the way he describes it, or his wife describes it in her autobiography, is that he had this dream when they were in Mexico that that his father told him that some copper was going to rust. And he thought that that meant that he, as a poet, was rusting and that he needed to return to his work. So the way he tells it, he had this dream and knew that he had to start writing again. But, you know, there was a lot of kind of circumstantial stuff around that that made it a lot easier for him to start writing. He wasn't worried about the FBI looking over his shoulder in Mexico anymore. He wasn't, you know, worried about his work being co-opted by the Communist Party during the Depression. He, you know, that events kind of conspired to make it a lot easier for him, I guess.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us, but she shared that she has a crippling depression, and it's very hard for her to talk about it with her friends. They don't even know that she has it. Issues like anxiety and depression play a role in keeping us silent?
Gosh, I mean, I think, that's terrible, and I think that's probably very common. So it's really interesting. In the book, I kind of go into this, the kind of foundation of this line called the Samaritans, which is for people, it's UK-based, to be able to talk about things like depression and anxiety they may not be able to talk about with their friends. And I was a volunteer for them for 10 years. And in the training, what they tell you is you have to kind of, you're trained in how to listen actively to people. And you're taught to kind of go with them into the darkness, into the like darker areas of their lives. Whereas in normal conversation, I think our immediate response is to be like, if someone says, for example, I'm really struggling, or, you know, I'm thinking of ending my life or whatever, the response is to be like, oh, well, you've got so much to live for, and there's this that's good and there's that that's good. And this desire to, rather than going alongside someone and actually like listen and be with them in what they're saying, I think in conversation, reaction is to try and pull away and give and kind of come up with the kind of counter, well, your life is because of this, that, or the other.
We're too busy trying to fix the problem
to talk about really, how you're feeling.
Yeah, to really pay attention.
Yeah, exactly.
What about the role of shame in all of this? You suspect that was another factor in Oppen's silence. Shame seems to be a big part of why people stay silent. And I'm thinking here of people who are, for example, sexual assault survivors not reporting crimes, or sons and daughters afraid to come out to their parents. Those are just a few big examples. How significant is the role that shame plays in all of this?
For sure. I mean, I think it's huge. Like I said, so for Oppen, he came from a very wealthy kind of Jewish background, and he stopped writing during the Great Depression. And for me, it's that he had this wealth, and yet he was wanting to be this kind of proletariat to the people. So there's that for him. And you're right, with whether it's kind of surviving abuse, talk about that, or
Harriet, we're having some technical issues with our connection to you, and let's take a moment and try to reestablish that, because this conversation is too important to let go. So we're going to take a break and see if we can fix this. We're talking about the times when language fails us, with Harriet Shawcross, a journalist and filmmaker, author of Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. What are those things for you? What areas are kind of no-go for conversation? Are there moments in your life where your words just fail you? You can't think of what to say about something. And there are a lot of times that we run into these situations where we just can't speak. We can't find the words. How's that for you? What have those situations been, and what did you do about it? Give us a call and share your stories at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Maybe you find power in silence. You value it. Or does too much of it scare you? I suppose it would be like having a fear of either being closed in or open spaces. It could work either way. Do you have difficulty speaking up or talking about certain aspects of your life, like a mental condition, like a crippling depression or grief? Are you trying to overcome that? What helps you to find your voice? What about shame or trauma? We've been talking about that. We'll pick that up on the other side of the news. Has what's held you back from talking? 800-642-1234. Harriet Shawcross is the author of Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Up next is the news, and then our conversation continues about the limits of language and when words fail us. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Harriet Shawcross is a filmmaker and journalist. Her new book is Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. We're talking about those times and situations when language fails us, when we cannot or will not speak. Do you have a story to share about a moment in your life where words just could not convey how you felt? If so, share it with us at 800-642-1234. Or maybe you find power in silence. Tell us about that as well. 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We were, Harriet, we were talking about shame. And when we started to have a few technical issues here, where there's shame, it also seems like trauma is nearby. Do you see these two powerful forces going hand in hand here?
Interesting. Yeah, yes, I guess so. I mean, certainly, you know, the example that you gave in terms of perhaps someone that had survived abuse, that makes sense. But I mean, in my case, for example, there was a very strong sense of shame around what had happened to my dad in terms of being made redundant. But I don't think there was any trauma associated with that. So I guess they're both really powerful forces that can make it harder for us to talk. But I guess I wouldn't say they're always connected, no.
You also spend some time in your book talking about sex, a topic that can be extremely difficult for people to have conversations about, even people who are married to one another. Expand a little more on that. Talk about how the relationship between sex and silence exists and why so many things go unspoken in this area.
Yeah, well, I'm aware I'm on a breakfast show here, so I don't know how much detail you want me to go into. But So in the book, one of the ways into talking about sex that I look at was I go and meet Eve Ensler, who wrote the Vagina Monologues back in the 90s. And for her, like a huge part of the taboos and the way in which we can struggle, particularly women, to articulate, you know, sexual desire is about that kind of shame and silence that surrounds the female body. And so her very strong belief is that in talking about the female body and like naming the vagina, it gives you more agency over your body. It allows you to talk about things that maybe you didn't have a language for before. So the example she gave was when she did the Vagina Monologues, she was expecting, you know, women to come forward with these stories of amazing orgasms and, you know, their sex life. And actually what happened was that at the end of each performance, she would have women kind of queuing around the block to come and tell her stories of rape, of incest, of abuse, of the kind of unspeakable sexual things that had been done to them. And that she found there was something about having an open conversation about the female body in the form of the Vagina Monologues that gave these women a language and a community to begin to articulate this stuff that they hadn't had any way of talking about before, which was obviously incredibly powerful.
Do you think the Me Too women have helped put words to a lot of things women in particular have experienced over the years?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting talking to Eve, you know, a lot of the work that she was doing back in the 90s in some ways did kind of prefigure what we can still see going on now. And yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, feeling that you are able to tell your story and be heard is obviously an incredibly kind of powerful thing.
We have a caller on the line. John joins us from Middleton. John, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
John, try again. We kind of lost you for a second there.
Oh, I'm sorry. My wife has major health issues. I have a daily conversation with her. And you mentioned earlier that perhaps trying to make her feel good might not be the best approach. Well, I don't know of any other approach to have. You mentioned that, you know, maybe listening better would be, but I'm not sure how that affects the person that's afflicted. What is better for them? Try to make them feel better or... Listen,
John. We're having a little bit of trouble with your phone, but I think we get the gist of this. When you were talking earlier, Harriet, about counseling people who are suicidal, but does that apply to people who are ill? What's the balance here between trying to make? If we're saying you'll get better or whatever, is that more about us or is that about the person we're talking to?
Gosh, it's really tough. And I think, you know, it sounds like he's in a really difficult situation there. And it is, you know, obviously very difficult to know the right thing to say. And there's obviously a place for conversation, especially from someone that's your partner who's there every day to say, come on, you know, things are going to be okay. You know, and trying to encourage people. I think there's obviously, you know, a huge need for that. I guess what my point was, when like Samaritans was set up, it was to provide an avenue for the conversations that maybe don't normally happen or that we aren't able to have. And maybe they're actually conversations that we couldn't have with the people closest to us, with our partners and caregivers and things, because they would just be kind of too upsetting for the other person to hear, where you kind of are really honest about how low you might feel or how, you know, how bad things are. And I guess the thinking for Samaritans certainly is that if you give someone space to articulate that and you're able to get alongside them, then that experience of being heard and being able to say things that you might have thought you couldn't say can be really powerful. But that said, obviously, if it's your wife or your husband that's saying these things to you, that can be incredibly difficult to hear. So I guess the question is kind of, there's a place for both of these types of conversations. And maybe there are things that we can't say or shouldn't say to certain people. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Harriet Shawcross is the author of Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. This seems like a good time to introduce the topic of death, which after sex is a big, we're not going to skip anything here. Right after sex, death is a big topic that trips us up when we try to talk about it. What is it that is that makes this maybe even a bigger taboo in some ways than sex, talking about death? And we often talk around it, don't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe it's the fact that none of us really want to admit that we're going to die. I don't know, that life is kind of built up to mask that kind of the reality that, you know, this we're only here for a short period of it. And and I guess it's just so kind of unknowable. It is, you know, the ultimate unknowable, and therefore, in that sense, the thing that is hardest to talk about. Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, where we encounter this is someone dies and we are maybe it's directly connected to us, or maybe it's the parent or sibling or friend of a loved one. And we're trying to offer comfort. That is a case of where words can often fail us, and we kind of resort to platitudes because we don't know what to say.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And I think, yes, absolutely. And I feel like I'm now kind of struggling to find the right thing to say. Because,
well, I think that illustrates the point exactly.
It doesn't.
You know, we don't know how to talk about not being able to talk about it because we're just so uncomfortable with it. Here's a person who's going through incredible trauma. What can we possibly say to them that's going to make this positive? Like, well, they're in a better place, or, you know, they're no longer in pain, and, you know, things that may in fact be true, but are not necessarily helpful.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I guess, so in the book, I went, the section of the book that looks at death, I kind of went to Nepal and was talking to people after there was this kind of big earthquake in 2015. And it was, I was talking to people afterwards about how do you deal with processing that kind of trauma of perhaps losing, you know, all the other members of your family, or, you know, death on that kind of scale, and whether talking about it helps or not.
And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I guess the only way to know is to be in that situation and find out firsthand. We had a tweet from Todd. Todd tweeted at us that being at a loss for words is rare for him. As a novelist, words are how he sees and feels the world and his place in it. But they fail sometimes because they are often inadequate, and one should perhaps invent new words.
That's really interesting. I think there's a couple of things there. Like, one, written versus spoken language. So certainly something I found as a journalist writing the book, like, you have such a lot of control, whether that's as a writer or a novelist or whatever, putting something down in writing. Whereas spoken conversation, there's inevitably an element of risk of, like, I don't know what you're going to say, you don't know what I'm going to say, and you don't know where this is going to go. And I think it's often in, you know, spoken conversation that you can be lost for words. Whereas if you have time, bereavement is a good example, for example, to sit down and think about a letter you might want to write to someone, often having the kind of control you have over a written text.
We used to be great letter writers as a society. That seems to be kind of the written word seems to be kind of a lost art these days. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, maybe. It's interesting. I don't know. And it feels a bit lame to blame kind of social media and the pace of life. But I think that probably is, you know, a big part of it. Again, going back to George Oppen, you know, he wrote letters every day, you know, huge, voluminous letters talking about poetry and life. And you wonder, you know, if it was today, he'd be sending that as, you know, WhatsApp messages or emails. I'm not sure.
Yeah, or tweeting about it, or posting to Facebook or some other social media platform, and then he would immediately be trolled by about 500 people.
Right, Harriet, so maybe that's it, yeah.
Yeah, Harriet Shawcross is the author of Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. Our conversation continues in a moment. You can join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Words, language. We use them all the time to communicate with one another, but what happens when words fail us? That's what we're talking about this morning with Harriet Shawcross, the author of Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. What are the things you can't say? What are the things you have trouble talking about? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have a caller, Doug, with us from Reedsburg. Doug, you're on The Morning Show. Good morning.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that talking about death is difficult. I've lost 4 children, and in talking about that, it's not so much having other people tell me their condolences, it's more just giving me the opportunity to describe how it feels to me, for me to work through my process. So it's been difficult. It's hard to go through that. It's taken time. But it's more about just having the other person there to listen, not necessarily what they need to say.
Doug, thanks for sharing that. Harriet, sometimes our silence is more of a comfort than whatever words we might have to say.
Yeah, no, I think that's amazing. And I'm so sorry to hear that, Doug. It's a terrible thing to have happened. I was just going to say, like, also, I think one of the things I was interested in the book is that often there are some experiences for which language is actually just not helpful. So, for example, they've done kind of brain scans on people who are have experienced, you know, extreme trauma. And during flashbacks, for example, the part of the brain that's being activated has nothing to do with the linguistic center of the brain. So in a sense, like telling the story of what happened may actually just not be helpful at all in terms of recovering. And there are some things that are experienced on a kind of physical, bodily level, that there's a line of thinking therapy that can engage with like kind of physical embodied trauma and kind of heal through the body without actually saying anything or talking about what's happened.
How much of our silences do you think are culturally related? We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who wanted to know about the role of culture plays in avoiding conversation. She shared that her family is Scandinavian and they have avoided talking about anything that would be uncomfortable. Coming from a Scandinavian background myself, I can tell you, you don't talk about things that are awkward. Those are just off the table. What's the role of culture here?
That's really interesting. And again, you know, full disclosure, I'm married to a Scandinavian, so I'm not to be down on Scandinavia at all here. I think it is very cultural. So, one of the things I look at in the book is kind of there's the Finnish notion of silence, and that small talk, in the sense that it exists maybe in the UK and the US, doesn't exist in the same way in Finland. And one anthropologist said that that might be because they industrialized as a surviving and putting food on the table. Who knows? But I think it is very culturally constructed. And for example, when I went, you know, the work I did in Nepal after the earthquake as well, kind of looking at the ways in which people dealt with that kind of trauma, and that it's quite cultural as to whether we feel that we need to kind of articulate what has happened to us or not. So for example, in Nepal, a lot of kind of trauma might be expressed in the body. You talk about having tension, in the heart mind, which is a kind of organ that we don't really have in the West, or they'd be kind of somaticized symptoms, whereas perhaps in the UK or the US, you'd be saying, I have PTSD, and this is what it feels like. So yeah, I think the way in which we use silence is very culturally dependent.
That's sort of the idea that there's something deeper than language. It's something within us that just can't be verbally expressed, and yet it's still there. So that's what you're describing here.
And I think towards the end of the book, that's what I found in terms of the kind of pull towards silence, in terms of whether there are things that cannot be communicated and the role that kind of silence has in that. So, for example, I went and spent some time on a kind of silent retreat that's in a like Buddhist context. And, you know, this comes with the caveat that I'm not a Buddhist, so apologies to anyone if I'm explaining this wrong. But my understanding of the way they viewed language was that it can often get in the way between two people, and it can become conversation can become a way of distancing ourselves from each other. So if I'm talking, I'm always asserting that I am me and you are you, and you know, you live in Wisconsin and you're a journalist and I live in the UK, and whereas if you strip all of that away and you remove all of the kind of stories that we weave around ourselves to tell ourselves who we are, it can give you a sense of kind of closer connection with other people, which was certainly what I found from spending time in kind of extended periods of time in silence, was a deeper sense of connection with people.
You also spent, let's take a phone call here. We've got a call from Claire, who's calling us from Appleton. Claire, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I just kind of wanted to speak on the, like, intense measure of silence and, like, versus someone trying to correct certain feelings of grief. And how important I think it is to not condemn people for, you know, what they're feeling, or maybe their desire to isolate themselves, or, you know, and I think sometimes with the like feeling of people wanting to correct that sense of grief is what leads to that isolation. And then it's kind of like, I've noticed it's just like this cycle that kind of perpetuates itself. So like one thing that I found when I've been like intense mourning or like extremely depressed, and when that isolation comes out, if someone just gently invites me out with them, and maybe there isn't a lot of pressure you know, it's one of those like no pressure friends where you can just like sit with them and talk and cry, and they aren't going to, you know, tell you that you're, you know, like, oh, you're being too dramatic, or oh, like, you know, one thing or other. But I think some of the best advice has been like seeing a therapist, or just kind of like sitting with friends who I trust. And I don't know. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. And sometimes I wonder, you know, like how to find those people. You know, trial and error in that way has been really complicated. And so I kind of wonder, you know, my question for the other person on air is like, how do you try to find boundaries with people, and what are like telltale signs to know whether or not someone is a safe person to speak with about these issues?
Claire, thanks so much for that call. What about those boundaries and looking for someone that you can talk to?
Gosh, I mean, with this, again, comes with the full disclosure. Like, I'm not a psychotherapist and not, you know, kind of trained in this area. It's purely been like personal interest and just talking to people about it. But I guess, I think, like you said, maybe it is just trial and error, and maybe starting with things that you feel relatively safe talking about and seeing how they're responding. Like, do you feel heard? Do you feel like they're giving you time to say what you need to say? Or do you feel like they're waiting to jump in with advice?
Harriet Shawcross is a filmmaker and a journalist. Her book is Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. And there probably are quite a few of those we cannot say because we lost our guest. And so we'll just have to leave those things unsaid. Maybe you've experienced something called a companionable silence. Well, on the radio, we call that dead air. Yes, this is so ironic. Thanks so much to Harriet for being with us this morning on the Ideas Network. Harriet Shawcross is a filmmaker and a journalist. Her new book, Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. I'm saying this. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.